and big children, is a presentation that's made during the Gita camp for children in Chicago. The way that it works is there's some of the devotees here, some of the youth, particularly some of the teenage girls from the Seattle congregation, have gone to attend, so they know what all this is all about. But for 2 weeks, there are two camps, each for 2 weeks, and they take a theme, a chapter of Bhagavad Gita, and everything is centered around that theme. And one of the things that's part of the experience is a PowerPoint presentation on one of the chapters of Bhagavad Gita. So, one of the chapters, one of the summers, was chapter 9, the most confidential knowledge. And I'm going to see if this works. This way. Chapter 9, The Most Confidential Knowledge. If I had more time, I would do a chapter summary and then show you this, but I'll just show you this. Chapter 9 of Bhagavad Gita is called The Most Confidential Knowledge. And there are different meanings of the word confidential. Like you tell something to somebody, that's one kind of confidential. Then there's another kind of confidential, and that's something that's very dear to you. Another kind of confidential. Others can know it, that's okay. It's very dear to you. Then there's another kind of confidential on the spiritual plane, and that comes in chapter 2, Bhagavad Gita. Confidential is who we really are. And who we really are is we're spirit soul. We're not matter. We're not gross or subtle matter. We're not different states of mind or this feeling or that emotion. We're spirit soul. And distinct from matter. That's confidential. And more confidential is to understand the distinction between the individual soul and the supreme soul. Chapter 4, Bhagavad Gita, discusses that transcendental knowledge. And then the relationship between the individual soul and the supreme soul, the exchange of love between the two, that's most confidential. That's what this chapter is. So Krishna begins the chapter calling it Parama Guhyam. Guhyam is confidential, and Parama Guhyam is most confidential. So, Raja Vija, Raja Guhyam, Pavitram Param, Idam Uttamam, Pratyakshavamam, Dharmyam Susukam, Susukam. There's Sukha and Susukha. It brings great happiness. Sukha. And it's inexhaustible. Sukha. Avyayam. So that's this chapter. And I'm not going to do a chapter review. That's how it begins. So I there's these introductory verses, the King of Knowledge verses, where Krishna, Krishna is describing how special is this chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So let's go there and hear what Krishna says.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I should impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization, knowing which you shall be relieved of the miseries of material existence. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed."
So that's the invocation verses at the beginning, where Krishna is describing how wonderful is the subject matter. But he then describes there's a certain qualification that you need in order to understand this most confidential knowledge. And that qualification is faith. So he says it positively and then says it negatively. Those that don't have faith can't understand. And those that do have faith enter into the mystery of this most confidential knowledge.
Those who are not faithful in this devotional service cannot attain me, O conqueror of enemies. Therefore, they return to the path of birth and death in this material world.
So, if this process is so wonderful, why don't we find more people take to it? So easy, so sublime, so joyful, so fruitful. Why isn't everybody doing it? And the answer is, they don't have faith. And there's different categories of lack of faith. Some persons just don't know. They've never been introduced to the scriptures. Some people know, they've been introduced to the scriptures, but they don't have belief in what the scripture is saying. Others are simply doubtful. They're hesitating, largely because of attachment to the material situation. If they give up their material situation, supposing there isn't something on the other end, then they're bereft. As Arjuna says in Bhagavad Gita, they're like a riven cloud with no position in any sphere. Again and again in Bhagavad Gita and other devotional texts, Krishna is describing this process of devotional service, but some cannot accept the supreme position of bhakti. They think some nice praise, but it's not to be taken seriously. It's not sentimental. It's not for highly educated people. Intellectual people don't go for this sentiment of bhakti. Some people think like that. Or they're just not interested, too busy with the pleasures of life. When this group of people, different categories of faithless persons, hear about the glories of devotional service, Prabhupada sometimes would use this example of the frog in the well. So regular devotees, you know this one, that those that are visitors, it goes like this. Once upon a time, there was a PhD frog, Dr. Frog, and he lived at the bottom of a well. And one time somebody came and told him, "Dr. Frog, there's a body of water so big, it's so much bigger than the water in your well." And Dr. Frog said, "How much bigger?"
Twice as big?
Oh, much bigger than twice as big.
5 times as big?
Much bigger. 10 times as big. Oh, it's vast. It's stupid. Prabhupada describes his head, the part of his neck that would expand out to show this big, this big, this big, and finally pop, exploded. Just like the frog in the well, hearing about the vastness of the ocean, he has no experience of the ocean and can't imagine the vastness of the ocean. Similarly, those that have the limited experience of what these senses can detect, and here's what's beyond the senses to detect, they can't accept it. Because it's beyond the senses and even beyond the mind, that the realm of spiritual reality. So they remain in this position, unfortunately, faithless and lacking in experience of the spiritual realm, spiritual happiness, spiritual reality. So there's a very nice definition of what faith is. If it's so important, what is it? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives this definition. Very simple. The definition is trust or confidence that if you achieve one thing, all other desirable things are automatically accomplished. To explain it, Prabhupada used money as an example. Everyone can understand money. If you have $1 million, you can solve your $10, $100 problems. So let me get that $1 million. So I can solve my $10, $100 problems. So by simile, by one thing, by giving my energy, my ability, my talent, my God-given gifts to God in service, everything is accomplished. The example is given just by watering the root of a tree. All the water goes to all the parts of the tree. By one thing, all the other things are accomplished. Just find the root of existence and place your energy, ability, talent, intelligence, everything upon the root of existence, and all of existence benefits. By one thing, all other desirable things are accomplished. That's faith. And it's true for worldly things. It's also true for spiritual things. It's practical. Not just a feeling, but bringing, just as Prabhupada describes what bhakti is, it's bringing the senses to sense objects and interacting in practical ways. And hesitation, reluctance should be given up. Krishna asks in one chapter in Bhagavad Gita, my dear Krishna, Arjuna asks, my dear Krishna, if people don't have faith in you, don't they have faith in something else? And the answer is yes, they'll have faith in something else. Because we operate on the, faith is intrinsic to the soul, we operate on the platform of faith. If we don't have faith in Krishna, we'll have faith in something. So devotional faith is created in the association of those who have devotional faith. Sangat sanjayate kama, in Krishna's language of Bhagavad Gita. We develop qualities like those with whom we associate. It's natural. Once Prabhupada was asked, Swamiji, how do I become sincere? And Prabhupada's answer was, how does one become a drunkard? You go to bars, the drinking places, and you associate with those people all day long, day after day, and you become a drunkard. Supposing you want to become a scholar, you enroll in university and associate with scholarly people, and through that association you can become scholarly. How do you become sincere? By associating with those that are sincere. How do you nurture faith? By associating with those who have faith. But by association with devotees. And how do you associate with devotees? Starting point is hearing. Just like this nice painting on the left, that's Maharaj Pariksit hearing from Shukadeva Goswami, and on the right, it's the persons who didn't know anything about anything spiritually, the American culture, and associating with Prabhupada became devotees just by hearing from him. And in addition to hearing, then also serving. This is the king, Prataparudra, who desired very much to serve Lord Chaitanya. So here we see him massaging Mahaprabhu's legs and feet halfway through Rath Yatra and Grand Road in Puri. By serving with humility and by hearing, faith naturally develops. And a very wonderful example of this is Narada Muni. Narada Muni, before he was Narada Muni in his previous life, he was Mr. Nobody. He was the son of a maid servant, Shudra, woman, and he didn't even know who his father was. The occupation of his mother was, she was assisting people who would stop at a dharmashala and just do whatever menial service was needed, and he assisted his mother. So one time during the rainy season, the 4 months of the rainy season, some sages stayed at that dharmashala, that inn, and he assisted them. He brought their meals, he would wash their clothes, he would get this, go for that, just some whatever it is that they needed. And he would hear their discussions. And in the course of time, as this painting shows, they developed some affection for this little boy, because his manner was mild. He didn't talk unnecessarily. Some children are like that. Some children aren't like that. But he was very calm, very peaceful. And so they began instructing him specifically. And they gave him not only teachings, but they gave him practices of meditation and mantra. And gradually, through their association, he took the remnants of their prasadam, and he describes to Vyasadeva, when he took their prasadam, he felt something. His attraction for Krishna was awakened. All these things together. Eventually, the sages left. Narada, during his previous lifetime, felt that the spiritual realization, awakening, he understood, he had realization of his soul distinct from the body. He could clearly understand Krishna's position. It gradually awakened with him just by the process of devotional service itself. And that by the process, eventually, one is meant to return back home, back to Godhead. So after the sages left, a providential arrangement took place. His mother was going to the well to get water, and on her way back she was bitten by a poisonous snake and died. So here's this little boy, without father, now without mother, and how unfortunate. He had no shelter, but he had shelter. He had the shelter of the personality of Godhead. By the mercy of these sages, he had learned how to receive that shelter. And so he took it, even a little boy, he took it that somehow this is some arrangement of the Supreme, I accept it. He left home at once and began traveling all throughout the land. It's described he went to the cities, he went to the forests, he went to villages, all over, in a fearless way, all the while, every morning, every evening, engaging in the same practices that he had learned from the sages. He was detaching himself from worldly existence and attaching himself more deeply to the Supreme. So one fine day, while meditating upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead within his heart, one day that Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared within his heart. And he was feeling ecstatic in seeing the Lord within his heart. And then suddenly as the Lord appeared, he disappeared. Narada was instructed by the Supreme Lord, "Normally I only appear to those who are fully purified. But I've shown my special mercy to you because you're so sincere. You will not see me for the rest of your life, but continue on in this way, and you will achieve spiritual perfection." He heard that as a voice. So he did like that. His whole rest of his life, he lived as it's been described already. And at the end of his life, Narada explained to Vyas, very nice simile, a metaphor. He said, just as lightning and illumination occur simultaneously, when I gave up my body, my spiritual form, as you see, the form of Narada, was manifest, and he attained spiritual perfection. Then the Personality of Godhead had some service for him to do. So he, Narada, said, along with the other living entities, at the time of the end of the day of Brahma, there's a partial devastation. He entered into the waters of devastation and then again into the body of Mahavishnu for the night of Brahma, and then again came out as the son of Brahma. 4,300,000,000 solar years later. That's a long sleep. But he came out as the son of Lord Brahma. And from that time, during this day of Brahma, for the entire duration of Brahma's day, he's serving the Personality of Godhead by carrying devotional service to others and given special powers that he can travel anywhere in the spiritual or the material realm. And he doesn't need a visa, doesn't need a passport, doesn't need an airplane, doesn't have any luggage, no check-in, no security. He just plays his veena and zoom, zoom, off he goes. Narada Muni Rajai Veena Radhika Ramana Namine. He just sings the names of the Lord and he's transported to wherever he wants to go. And where does he want to go? He wants to go where there's some opportunity to deliver devotional service. And there's lots of opportunity, lots of conditioned souls in this created realm. So there's an example of how faith was created or awakened by association. And as with Narada, so with the followers of Narada, the same principle applies. So, there's the example of the role of faith, back to Bhagavad Gita chapter 9. Without it, one can't understand this message. And with faith, through the association and service of devotees, one can develop faith and then one can understand this message. So here's the message.
Krishna's unmanifested form pervades everything, but Krishna himself remains detached from matter. Material nature, working under his direction, produces all moving and non-moving beings.
Material nature, under his direction, produces all moving and non-moving beings. To understand that relationship between all things and the source, Krishna speaks these verses. Listen carefully, they're very deep and profound.
By me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence.
Now, what does it mean that everything rests upon Krishna? It's not like the mythological Atlas, big biceps and carrying the world on his shoulders. Krishna does just by his own potency, by his willing potency. He makes no effort, and yet everything is sustained by him. Like the picture shows, Krishna is aloof. He's enjoying his pastimes in Goloka Vrindavan, but by his potencies, the modes of nature are acting and controlling the activities of all living entities. So everything is being carried out by Krishna's inconceivable potency. That's very, very necessary to understand about how things work and how Krishna does what he does by his potencies. While he's different from the material manifestation, he's also personally present through his potencies and his expansion as Paramatma. This is Krishna's mystic power.
Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not a part of this cosmic manifestation. For myself is the very source of creation. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me. O son of Kunti, at the end of the millennium, all material manifestations enter into my nature. And at the beginning of another millennium, by my potency, I create them again. The whole cosmic order is under me. Under my will, it is automatically manifested again and again. And under my will, it is annihilated at the end. O Dhananjaya, all this work cannot bind me. I am ever detached from all these material activities, seated as though neutral. This material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O son of Kunti. Producing all moving and non-moving beings. Foolish persons do not know Krishna's transcendental and supreme nature. They consider the human-like form of the Lord to be material. The great souls, however, are undiluted.
Just go back a bit. One reference from that section. It's very important and it's very difficult to understand the relationship between God's creation and himself. So when you read that section, it's not easy. It's transcendentally challenging. Krishna is simultaneously one with everything and simultaneously different from everything. That sounds like a contradiction. It's either one or the other, but it's simultaneously both. But to help understand that apparent contradiction, Krishna gives an example, a metaphor. The metaphor is, there's the vastness of sky and there's the wind that's blowing in the vastness of sky. So as the wind is blowing in the vastness of sky, what happens to the sky? Nothing. Because the sky is more subtle than the wind. That which is swirling and moving and tempestuous is undisturbing that in which the wind rests, because it's more subtle. And similarly, Krishna is the subtle est He's the source of everything. Everything rests in Him. But as everything is moving, He's not moving. He's not affected. Moving and non-moving beings, everything comes from Him. But He's not affected by its coming, by its changes and transformations, by its being withdrawn. He's not affected because He is the very source of it all, being the supreme, subtle existence, primordial existence. And then he describes that relationship a bit further. So those that don't understand because of the lack of faith, they have a different idea when they hear about creation or they hear about Krishna. They, as this section is going to say, because they don't understand, because they're faithless, they deride. They think that Krishna, if there is Krishna, he's one of us, he's just a better version, a higher grade, a very refined quality of goodness, Krishna. But he has a material body like us. There are those that think that way. Krishna explicitly says, those who think that way, they're mudhas. They're wrong. They're mistaken. They're fools. More blunt language. And then there are the great souls that have a proper understanding, and there are degrees of proper understanding also. That's in this section.
What happened?
Fools deride me when I descend in the human form. They do not know my transcendental nature as the Supreme Lord of all that be. Those who are thus bewildered are attracted by demonic and atheistic views. In that deluded condition, their hopes for liberation, their fruitive activities, and their culture of knowledge are all defeated. O son of Pritha, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible, always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination bowing down before me. These great souls perpetually worship me with devotion.
Now, a aside from those who worship Krishna in the way that's just described, in a very liberal way, Krishna describes other forms of worship where the worship is indirect, but he very broadly and mercifully accepts them as his devotees also.
Others, to engage in sacrifice by the cultivation of knowledge. Worship the Supreme Lord as the one without a second, as diverse in many, and in the universal form. But it is I who am the ritual. I, the sacrifice, the offering to the ancestors, the healing herb, the transcendental chant, I am the butter and the fire and the offering. I am the father of this universe, the mother, the support and the grandson. I am the object of knowledge, the purifier and the syllable Om. I am also the Rig, the Sama and the Yajur Vedas. I am the goal. The sustainer, the master, the witness. The abode, the refuge. And the most dear friend. I am the creation and the annihilation, the basis of everything, the resting place, and the eternal seed. O Arjuna, I give heat, and I withhold and send forth the rain. I am immortality, and I am also death personified. Both spirit and matter are in me.
Different worshippers reach different goals. Men who want to attain the heavenly planets worship the demigods, and then take birth among them to enjoy godly delights. But such men, after exhausting their pious credits, return to earth. Men who worship ancestors go to the planets of the ancestors, and those who worship ghosts become ghosts. But one who worships Krishna with exclusive devotion goes to him forever.
There is an idea that's promoted sometimes. All roads lead to Rome, or all paths lead to the same result. You've heard that one before?
Those who study the Vedas and drink the soma juice,
Krishna says something
heavenly
else.
Planets, worship me indirectly. Purified of sinful reactions, they take birth on the pious heavenly planet of Indra, where they enjoy godly delight. When they have thus enjoyed vast heavenly sense pleasure and the results of their pious activities are exhausted, they return to this mortal planet again. Thus, those who seek sense enjoyment by adhering to the principles of the three Vedas achieve only repeated birth and death. But those who always worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lacked. And I preserve what they have. Those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith, actually worship only me, O son of Kunti. But they do so in a wrong way.
avidhi purvakam is Krishna's language. Vid means to know, and avid means they don't know. Avidhi purvakam, they're guided by misunderstanding, or they do so in the wrong way. It's very explicit. And their destination is also different, as described.
I am the only enjoyer and master of all sacrifices. Therefore, those who do not recognize my true transcendental nature fall down. Those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. And those who worship me will live with me.
I like that. Shows a devotee sitting there chanting japa before the deity, and then look at this.
Whatever Krishna's devotee does, eats, offers, or gives away in charity, he does as an offering unto the Lord. Krishna reciprocates by carrying what his devotee lacks and preserving what he has. By taking shelter of Krishna, even low-born persons can attain the supreme destination.
So this is the bhakti principle being expressed here. Whatever it is that you do, do it for Krishna. Whatever you eat, whatever austerities, whatever sacrifices, whatever, do that for Krishna. Offer with devotion and love, Krishna will accept.
If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, I will accept it. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, and whatever austerities you perform, do that, O Salaputi, as an offering to me. In this way, you will be free from bondage to work and its auspicious and inauspicious results. With your mind fixed on me and this principle of renunciation, you will be liberated and come to me. I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone. I am equal to all. But whoever renders service unto me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I am also a friend to him. Even if one commits the most abominable action, if he is engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered saintly because he is properly situated in his determination. He quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. O son of Kunti, declare it boldly that my devotee never perishes. O son of Pritha, those who take shelter in me, though they be of lower birth, women, Vaishyas, merchants, and Sudras, workers, can attain the supreme destination. How much more this is so of the righteous Brahmanas, the devotees, and the saintly kings. Therefore, having come to this temporary, miserable world, engage in loving service unto me. Engage your mind, always thinking of me. Become my devotee. Offer obeisances to me. worship me. Being completely absorbed in me, surely you will come to me.
This is Krishna and Arjuna going to Mahavishnu's abode to search for the sons of the Brahmana in Dwarka that were missing. Inviting us to come back to him. He's giving us the means to come back to him. He's giving us instructions, a roadmap, the best GPS available, how to get to the goal, the spiritual world. He's describing the detours that you have to watch out for. He's making it very easy for us. But there's something from our side that we need to do. We need to sincerely desire with faith in his words. Not blind faith, not just close your eyes and hope it's like that, but with careful consideration, with gradual unfolding of the process of realization. The process of devotional service gives realization. And gradually, gradually progressing towards this supreme destination. And the concluding verse of the chapter, I'll just repeat it. He gives four things that are quite simple. Even a child, we were just watching, even a child can do. Pay your obeisances. Become, to think of Krishna, become his devotee. Pay obeisances to him. Madhyaji, worship him. In this way, practicing that, cultivating, it's actually natural, but cultivating that aptitude, you'll go to Krishna. Krishna's inviting, that's the means, please take the means. Hare Krishna, nice chapter, huh? So any comments or any discussion? Did you like? Yeah? Yeah.
Hi, Kumar. The suggestion is to do this review kind of lecture. Because by contrast, you discuss the general of Bhagavad-gita or Bhagavatam as transfers, presence in your verse. And the whole teacher is nice to.
Sure. Well, let me give credit to Jai Radhe Dasi. She did this. A little help from her husband on the technical side, but you know, I'm able to make this presentation because she did all the work. I just traveled around and shared it with others. But it takes a lot. It's not just technical skill, it's you know, it's sensitivity. So, I didn't do it.
Just the narration is good. You know, it's like it doesn't have to be in the slides. If you go through the chapter quickly and after reading the verse, point out the points.
Visuals help immensely. I mean, I was looking around as, you know, it's absorbing. It's not just, you know, this audience, it's in general. I'll just share something on a personal side. The first temple that I joined or became a member of the ashram was in Boston. And I had visited some other places, but I liked that place especially for a number of reasons. And one of those reasons was the art department was there. In fact, the whole book production was there in the Boston Temple. So the way that it worked was Prabhupada sent some recorded, some of those little miniature audio cassettes at the time, and then some of the transcribers would transcribe. Then the transcriptions would go to the artists. And then the artists would sit together and they had a production line. They conceptualized what it would be, what paintings would illustrate the work. And one artist made the pencil, you know, where everything would go on the page, on the canvas. Then another filled it in, and then another came and did all the finish work, all the jewels and fine, very, very fine. And three people, it was Bharadraj, Jadarani, and Muralidhar, and they produced so many paintings. So my service was different. I was going out on Harinam and distributing Back to Godhead magazines, and every day. Try again. Every day at the end of the Harinam day, we weren't supposed to go and disturb the artists, but I went up the back stairway, and they got used to me coming. So I would just sit in front of the paintings, and it was like the spiritual world was unfolding. That was this, you know, 21-year-old idealistic, enthusiastic young brahmachari that knew nothing about nothing, and the spiritual world was opening up. And that visual experience of the spiritual world opening up, even before the book was published, to see the paintings that, and then they would narrate as they were continuing with the, you know, tell the story or give the message from the scripture, from the Bhagavatam. And I felt like I was being drawn into the spiritual world through the ear and through the eye and through these wonderful devotees that were explaining and narrating. And they were just repeating what they heard from Prabhupada. They weren't realized souls, but they were very faithful to their spiritual master. And their service was to depict what he said on canvas, open up the spiritual world. So that's how I grew up, in, you know, my baby days in Krishna consciousness. So visual presentations mean a lot. They resonate very much. You know, I learned a lot that way, and I feel it makes it easy to hear the message, to see it visually, and it makes a strong impression. One other thing, when this summer camp first started, the Gita camp, it was very new, the concept was new, the experience was new, everyone was very excited, and they found that at the end of the first week, just seeing the pictures, the children could then recite the verses for the whole chapter of Bhagavad Gita from visual translated into oral. And so then it wasn't just reciting verses, but because you can ask children, you know, can you recite, you know, such and such verse? And they can say the verse, and then you ask them, what does it mean? And they say, I don't know. But this way they know. It's very powerful. The presentation is very powerful. Children can understand. Adults can understand. People with different culture can understand. It's really fantastic. Very, very powerful educational tool. Visual and oral. And then get the message. Is there anything else? Yes?
Maharaj, this is on the topic of association.
Okay.
So from here, most of us most of the time we associate ourselves with capitalists in the workplace.
Okay.
And so, how do we really imbibe spirituality during that during the time at work, especially when we are so immersed in just making money for the company and for ourselves?
Well, change the channel. You don't have to change the activity, but change the consciousness channel. And there are several things to do. This is a standard question that you're asking, and there are several things to be said about that standard question, and go further and deeper into each one of those. But one primary starting point is perform good sadhana before you go to the workplace so that your Krishna consciousness each morning is awakened and you're feeling some connection with Krishna through that nice sadhana. Then you go into the workplace and what the company is thinking and what you're thinking may be very different. What you're thinking is, I'm Krishna's representative. I have an assignment from Krishna. And that assignment from Krishna is to show by example and by qualities what it means to be a God-conscious person in the workplace. I have a mission. So, in course of time, the people in the workplace, and you can translate this to school kids. Any school kids here? Few. So when you're in school, same thing as in the workplace. You have a mission, because in course of time, the other kids in school are going to know you're a Krishna devotee. I mean, you may not say it, but you may say it, and in course of time, they'll come to know. So you're representing Krishna in the workplace or in school. Whether you understand it or not, like it or not, that's the reality. And so you should perform well in the workplace or in school, because if you don't, people are going to say, look at these people, these Krishna people, they do lousy in workplace or lousy in school. You know, I don't want to have anything to do with that, because I want to do well in the workplace and in school. But if you're doing it for Krishna and you excel in the workplace or in school, something else happens. Hey, check this out. And not only do you excel, but you have these wonderful qualities that, like, people do mean-spirited things in the workplace and you don't participate in any of that. People get stressed out like anything when there's a deadline for the product or whatever it is. And you don't get stressed out. And people do the blaming other people program. You don't do that because you're a devotee and you're 10 steps ahead of everybody, because you're not thinking about all that garbage. You're thinking about serving Krishna and setting a nice example in the workplace. So people will ask you, what's happening? You're so peaceful when everybody else is all stressed out around here. What's the secret? They'll start asking you. You don't have to tell them. They'll ask you if they see those qualities. And so forth. Somehow or another, this little... As a sannyasi, I can't go into that workplace. It will be inappropriate. But you hearing and receiving, you go... Take everybody, multiply it by so many persons here just in this room, and you're contacting so many persons every day, collectively. You're carrying Krishna consciousness in your heart. You're part of Lord Chaitanya's process of spiritualizing the place based upon that nice, carefully executed sadhana you do every day. And the way that you associate with the devotees outside of the workplace. You're carrying that with you into the workplace. You're a little messenger, secret agent.
for Krishna.
To give through the bhakti that you're carrying in your heart, give bhakti to others. Indirectly, unconsciously, or distribute prasadam or something or other. And like, you know, with for the kids, with same in the school place, you show what it is to have good character and not circumstance dependent. I have nice character when I'm in school, when I'm in the temple, then in the school, you know, you have this split personality and this mask, and take off the mask when you get back into the temple. You're one person. You're who you are. And you're the same person, whether you're in this environment, that environment. And through your example, you're showing this is what devotion to Krishna is. And when there's some dialogue, you can share. You have to, like, put it in their face. You gently, when they ask you, hey, how come you're eating these foods? Or whatever it is. What are these pictures that you have by your computer? Or I see that you know, before you eat, you say some prayers, or whatever it is. They'll ask you, and then you can say. And sometimes there's a calamity. A family, somebody dies, or somebody gets some terrible disease, and they'll go to that spiritual person and say, you know, I'm all stressed out, I see that you're a spiritual person, please help. They may not say it in those words, but that's the message. And then you have another opportunity to do some service on behalf of Krishna. So you're Krishna's emissary in that place. They're thinking one thing, you're thinking another thing. You do your work very nicely, not for the same reason that they're doing, but for Krishna's service. And there's so many more things to be said, but that's a nice beginning. Do that and you're doing great. Anything else? Yes.
Maharaj, chapter 9, verse 3, Ashratama Purusha says, those who are not faithful in this devotional service cannot attain me. It's a pretty straightforward,
like, yeah.
Laser sharp.
Yeah.
That means people who are following Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga.
No. To have Jnana Yoga. Did you hear the question in the back?
No.
You heard? Fantastic. Some say yes, some say no. I'll repeat the question. In the third verse of chapter 9, Krishna speaks about those who are faithless cannot attain me. So the question is, those who are practicing the other forms of yoga, Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, what about them? The answer is, the very word yoga means there's some element, some component of bhakti. Otherwise, the term yoga would not be appropriate. So, primarily interested, just like that later on in the chapter, there's this example, those who are inclined to study scriptures, they worship me indirectly in the following ways. And it gives three examples. Ekadvena pataktvena bahuda vishvato lukam. They worship me as one. They worship me as many. They worship me as the universal form. Krishna includes them as his devotees. It's the broad, very liberal net that Krishna is casting. Because if there's yoga, even as jnan yoga or karma yoga or dhyan yoga, the yoga term means there's some devotion. So those persons can become, the answer is, those persons can become gradually elevated, and that's the objective. That gradual elevation then leads to the direct devotional service. And that's what Krishna advocates at the end of Bhagavad Gita. Sarvadharmam pratyaja mami kam sharanam. Anything else? Yes. Krishna expands himself as Paramatma within the heart, but Bhagavan remains in Krishna Loka. Krishna is everywhere in the form of his energies, in the form of his personal expansion as Paramatma, but he's localized in the spiritual world. He has that abode. And Krishna doesn't leave his abode. He never leaves Vrindavan. But he expands himself. Like that. Okay? Yes? I was listening carefully to your question, and the last part, you lost me, because there are different ways that people can have the concern that you expressed. Is your question, is Krishna impartial by sanctioning bad things? That's your question? If Krishna is impartial, Krishna is impartial, but if he's impartial, how can he then sanction you to do bad karmas or other to do bad karmas against you and causing further implication?
Yes. So why do you do bad things in the world? Why do you do duality? Why not just one thing?
And the answer is, listen carefully, Krishna is loving. Now, let me ask you a question. You have children? Do your children ever do something you don't want them to do? Never, right? Sometimes it happens. Now, how do you feel about that? You don't want them to do it, but they have free will, and they do it. But you love them, and you may go and say to them, "This was not good. You were running across the street and right in the middle of the traffic, and you can get squashed, you can get hurt. So don't do that."
My mommy doesn't let me go out and play.
Like that. The sanction is because there's free will. You're the mother. You don't want them to do bad things, but you don't want to take away their free will. You can't anyways. It's constitutionally theirs. So Krishna doesn't interfere with our free will. He advises us, don't misuse your free will. You advise your children. But sometimes they do it anyways. You still love them, so you may correct them. So Krishna is the supreme controller, but he doesn't interfere with our free will. It's our constant. As he has unlimited free will, we're his part and parcel, we have tiny free will. We're qualitatively like him, and he loves us. And if we wish to misuse our free will, he doesn't interfere with it. He advises us otherwise, but he doesn't interfere with it. And so this realm is created for those of us who misused our free will in rebellious spirit. We wanted to enjoy independent of Krishna's will, Krishna's happiness, Krishna's pleasure, outside of love. We wanted independent happiness. So with reservation, Krishna made the arrangement. And all the while advising us, please don't do this. I want to do it.
As a parent, Maharaja, whenever, if
Nonetheless, the free will is there. And Krishna's position is not giving the environment, but he's reciprocating. Yayitam mam prapadyante. Prapadyante means surrender. As they surrender unto me, I reciprocate. So supposing someone's disposition is, see you later. Goodbye, Krishna. I want to enjoy independently from you. There's no such thing, enjoying independently. I want to enjoy. So an illusion is created. This is the good news. The bad karmas is like a bad dream. How real is a bad dream? When you wake up, it was just a dream. This material existence is illusory. That's the good news. Now, the solution is to regain our proper use of free will. But Krishna doesn't interfere. This is your question was his neutrality. Towards those who have a bad attitude, Krishna doesn't, you know, dismiss them. He creates that which they want with the caution. This is illusory. There's no real happiness here. So it's not exactly sanctioning bad karma. It's creating an illusory situation. It's like anesthesia, putting someone to sleep so you can perform surgery. How can a doctor do that? They put the person to sleep. It's to allow the surgery to take place. So for Krishna, Krishna's interest is to correct the misuse of free will. And so he gives this illusory realm where people are doing good karmas and bad karmas and all types of things, getting all types of forms and species of life and so on. And it's all illusory. And it's brought into being, stays for some time, and is withdrawn. And then for some time it's held, and then again it unfolds. And we take it as real. But his message is, it's not. And there is an ultimate reality. So that's the truth with a capital T, or the reality with a capital R, and the other is an illusory reality. Because I stamp my little foot and say I want independent enjoyment, fundamentally that's a misuse of free will. And with that there's good karma, bad karma, but it's all misuse of free will. Good karma, bad karma included. Good karma is misuse of free will, provided it's separate from the interest of the Supreme Lord. So I want to attain the heavenly pleasures, independent of the happiness of the Supreme Lord. It's misuse of free will. The whole creation is a product of our misuse of free will. So Krishna doesn't interfere with that. He creates that good karma, bad karma mix. Heavenly planets, hellish planets, and in-between planets. And various species and gradations of life according to the consciousness of the individual. It's like a bad dream. The whole thing is a bad dream. Even, you know, sitting on the throne as a king, it's a bad dream. Because we've forgotten our relationship with Krishna. That's the transcendental perspective. That's Krishna's perspective. Name vesho stina priyaha. I don't have adversity towards anyone. I don't hold anyone especially dear. He's neutral. It's right in the chapter. Thank you. Yes.
So Maharaj, I have some clarification that you mentioned there. My question is from yesterday.
I'll repeat his question.
So, like, Bhagavat is not different than Krishna.
Bhagavat is not different than Krishna.
Yeah. So, the Sanskrit word is like, the Bhagavat is a Vangamaya, the body of Krishna. So, not different than Krishna.
Yeah.
So, sometimes certain time and certain things, we do some things. But, like, we did today class is different, the Krishna class. So, like we have, like sometime yesterday when you were in class, you have a bhagavatam in your hand and saw the bhagavatam. So now the devotee is using iPod. So the Prabhupada said that I'm with my book always. So if there is a text in the same, the bhagavatam is. So, but if devotee has a bhagavatam in the home, if he doesn't have Krishna deity, he can worship the Bhagavatam.
Sure.
But he cannot worship the iPod.
Why not?
Huh?
Why not? Krishna's present in electronic form. Why not? He's everything.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. What's worshipable about trees, cotton, pigments, and printer's ink? They're material. What's the Bhagavatam that you saw me holding yesterday?
Like
trees, cotton, pigments, and, you know, black ink. Put together in a certain way, and now it's worshipable. Supposing the same transcendental message is presented in electronic format, it's no less. It's the you know, there's a cover over the Bhagavatam that's electronically stored in that little iPad, but the Bhagavatam is inside, electronically stored, and can present itself. So it's just like, you know, any other book. It's not holy, but there. The word of God is holy, but the form of its presentation is trees, cotton, you know, binding, glue, colors, pigments, and printer's ink. Maybe some plastic because, like, you know, the covers now. So it's oil. It's just, you know, elements from the earth put together in a particular form, and now it's in the Bhagavatam. And same.
But if we all use the iPad, then Prabhupada's book is not going to be true. We're going to pick.
That's something else. That's something
iPod
else.
The using the
in San Jose, in Silicon Valley, they're distributing e-books. Because that's a format, technology format, that people are inclined to. So they're selling them. Here, take one. Put it in your Kindle, or put it in your iPad, or put it in your computer, and then you can read it. If your concern is it's going to diminish the sales of Bhaktivedanta Book Trust, that's one thing. But is it worshipable or not? It's worshipable. So the BBT has to get up to speed with modern technology and figure out how to get into that market where people are, they would prefer reading their Kindle rather than reading a book. Some people would prefer reading the book. Some people would prefer reading their iPad. So it's the BBT's challenge to get the get up to speed with technology and make that. And they're doing it. It says they're a little slow, but they're doing it. Okay. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Sweets for you to distribute.